Okay, it's October 22nd, 2019, the VIHG in Rhode Island, and we're studying Bhagavatam, Canto 6, Chapter 16, verses 40 to 49. So here we're going to be looking pretty much exclusively at the concept of Bhagavad Dharma. Looking mostly at Bhagavad Dharma and an Aryan who's a person who follows Bhagavad Dharma. So the summary of this is that in his prayers, Chitraketu glorified Bhagavad Dharma as the only true religion. And this concept, of course, of, you know, what is religion is a big one today. So I'm born citizen of America, and in the Constitution of the United States, it says that the government will neither establish a religion or prohibit a religion. So the government can't do anything to help religions or anything to hurt religions. It has to be neutral towards religion. But then the question arises, what's a religion? What is a religion? And because the government is not supposed to establish a religion, the government has a very difficult time deciding what is a religion. What does it mean for something? Yes?
And the president of the United States can be part of a religion?
The government cannot establish a religion. Just like in the UK, there is the Anglican Church is the official church of the United Kingdom. But in the United States, we can't have any official church. But this question of what is a religion, so the government has some idea, you should have a doctrine, you should have something you believe, you should have some sort of a history, even if it began yesterday, you have to have some kind of a history. They have some criteria. But for example, there's at least two groups I know of in America who have protected government status as religion. One, and this is true, okay? This is, you can look it up if you like, giving you factual information. One of them is the Church of Satan. So, and there's a lot of agitation from the Church of Satan that they'll say, you know, at Christmas time, if the government puts up a Christmas tree, they want to put up a statue of Satan. And the other is, and again, I'm not making this up, the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster. I told you I'm not making this up. You can look it up on the internet yourself. It's called the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster. And there was a recent thing in many governments in the United States, they will have a religious leader give some kind of a prayer or opening statements when they open their government business. Like if they're going to open their Congress, they'll have somebody give a statement. And they've always had people from majority religions. So mostly different Christian groups do this. But I believe it was in Alaska where they decided that this needed to be open to any religion. Because, you know, it wasn't fair to do it just to majority. It wouldn't be in keeping with the Constitution. And so a representative, and again, this is actual news, a representative from the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster, he sat in the Congress, I think it was of Alaska, I can't remember the state, I think it was Alaska, this is very recent, and he offered some sort of a benedictory prayer while he was wearing a colander on his head. Do you know what a colander is?
Yes. For the spaghetti is not to roll down.
Yeah, so when you're cooking, you have this metal thing with holes in it. Yeah, so the water can go out, but the spaghetti. So he wore one of these on his head. And he was talking about how the universe was created by the flying spaghetti monster. So, and it's debatable. People debate, are these people, do they really believe this? Or Are they just making a parody of religion? But they're registered as a religion in the United States. Now, in Indonesia is officially a Muslim country, but they allow for a plurality of religions. But in Indonesia, you are supposed to register as belonging to a particular religion. But I believe you only have six choices. I think it's Islam, Catholicism, Protestantism, Hindu, Buddhism, maybe one other. Judaism is not a choice, by the way, in Indonesia. And in order to be a religion in Indonesia, you have to worship one God, and you have to say who is your one God, and you have to have a scripture. You may have to have something else too, but you have to have a scripture and one God. And we had difficulty in ISKCON. ISKCON was banned from Indonesia for 15 years because some preachers came in there and said, we're not Hindus. But you have to, in order to function in Indonesia, you have to identify yourself as one of these six religions. It's on your identity card and so forth. And if you have another religion, you're discriminated against as far as housing, jobs, education, and so many things. So finally, after 15 years, ISKCON said, oh, by the way, we've decided that we're actually Hindus. And it's interesting because in order for Hinduism to be recognized as a religion, it had to put forward one God and one scripture. But Hinduism has trouble with who is the one God. We were talking about this yesterday with the demigods. And there are different Hindu groups in Indonesia. So you can look this up. They made one up. They made up a god. They call him Brahman. So they use the name Brahman. But they have a deity of this made-up god. He's not anywhere in any scriptures. So it's how do we tell what is a religion? How do we know what's a religion? I can give my own answer to this. So first of all, a religion should be able to answer, should be able to give some, and this is just Urmila Devi Dasi's, just me speaking right now. A religion should be able to answer questions like, who is God? Who am I? What is the purpose of creation? What happens when I die? Why is there suffering? My own personal definition of religion is it should be able at least to give some kind of answers to those questions. That religion should be answering the big existential questions of life and giving you some process by which you can realize those. That would be how I would answer that question. Which of course would put some things in the category of a religion that probably aren't a religion according to our Shastra. But at least it should be able to answer those questions. First time we met Srila Prabhupada in 1974, he said a religion is bona fide if it teaches you how to know and love God. So this was Srila Prabhupada's very, very simple, and it's something that Srila Prabhupada repeats over and over and over again. That it's, if you know God and you come to love God, then that is a bona fide religion. But how do we decide what is a bona fide religion? This is not a small question. And I think as preachers of Krishna consciousness, people come to us and ask us, how do we know that Krishna consciousness is true? And how do we know that it's a bona fide religion? And I do find that it does come down to matters of faith and experience. If I just say, well, our scriptures have gone back to the beginning of creation, how do I prove that? Do I have any way to prove that? Definitely not.
Only by the
scriptures. Only by the scriptures themselves.
Yeah, by practicing.
Well, that's another thing. But if I say, the scriptures go back to the beginning of creation, we say that there's been many destructions since the creation of the universe. that this entire planet has been destroyed many, 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 many times at the end of every day of Lord Brahma, and Brahma is 51 years old. So he's had a lot of days. And each of those days, this earth is destroyed. So there's not going to be any kind of archaeological evidence going back billions and billions and billions, gazillion years to the beginning of the creation. You know, and a lot of the evidence in India is written on leaves. The scriptures were written on leaves. They weren't generally written on stone. And you know what? Leaves don't last very long. Leaves are not something that stays for a long time. There's an oral tradition, but again, if you're looking at evidence, if we're looking at some sort of archaeological evidence, it's not so easy. And there's a lot of debate among scholars and archaeologists, how far back does the Vedic religion go? What did it look like? And there's not a consensus of opinion if we're looking at empiric evidence. Yes? This is just the fact if we're looking at empirical evidence. So we can say, well, the scriptures make this claim about themselves. Now, of course, we're in this situation with any sort of historical claim about anything. You know, there's a limited amount of physical, tangible, historical evidence going back very far. It's very limited, and then it's very subject to interpretation. So everyone agrees that the pyramids and the Sphinx are very old. But what do they represent is a matter of conjecture. There's not agreement about it. You know, and there's ancient sites of human civilization, and there's some existent human writing from far in antiquity. But again, what exactly does it mean? Is a subject matter of debate. One devotee gave me a book many years ago. I think it was called Motel of the Mysteries. I believe that was the name. And it was a parody of archaeology. The story, it was written for young people. It was about 2,000 years in the future, where archaeologists dig up a hotel of the modern day, and they are guessing what it was, and they guess that it's a temple. And so they decide that the television was the god. So it was a very funny book, but it was just showing how when you dig up these old ruins and you try to figure out what is this, what is that, what does it mean, you try to reconstruct the civilization from the ruins, you may not get a clear picture. So when we say to people our religion is bona fide because it is eternal, it comes from the beginning of the creation, we don't have some sort of physical proof of that, nor could we. According to our own scriptures, having physical proof of that on this planet would actually be impossible. Everything would have been destroyed. So on what basis can we say that what we're teaching is the eternal universal religion? And we're going to look at that today in terms of Bhagavad Dharma. Now, like what Mahalakshmi said, it's a question of experience. You know, when Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita 9.2, Pratyaksha Bhagavan Dharma, this Dharma is something that you experience. As George Harrison wrote in his Foreword to Krishna book, the proof of the pudding is in the eating. How do we know that this is the eternal occupation of the soul and is universal? Ultimately, our ultimate only way of knowing is by our own experience. There really isn't any other ultimate concrete evidence that we could give to somebody that would say, here you have proof, absolute proof that nobody could argue with. Yes? Yes.
Because
All right, let's go down that route for a little while. So let's say that we want to say that the eternal religion, which of course is exactly what's stated in the Mahabharata, the verse that's quoted all the time, that you don't just look at the scriptures, you don't just look at logic, you look at the Mahajanas. You follow the path of the Mahajanas. Now, if we do that, we do still have a problem with that, but on the positive side, we would then identify persons throughout human history in a variety, because we're talking about a universal religion, yes? We're talking about something that's universal. We're not talking about an ethnic culture. Yes, sir? May we help you?
Sorry, Mother, I'm looking for Adi Krishna Prabhu.
He is not to be found in this room. You might find him upstairs.
Thank you.
There are certainly ethnic religions, which there are religion associated with a particular physical type of person in a particular culture. And often those religions don't even claim to be universally applicable. Judaism is a religion like that. They really discourage people from becoming Jews if you're not born Jew. They say, don't do it. They say, Jews have 613 rules, you only have 10. Just stick, seriously. They say, just stick with who you are, don't become Jewish. So that's a very ethnic religion. And for many years, Hinduism was presented as an ethnic religion. You have to be born into Hinduism, you can't really become a Hindu. It's not really applicable to everybody of the world. And the Hindus said, you know, everybody else has their own religion and that's cool. And we have, you know, they dealt with it in that way. But of course, Rupa Goswami talks about bhakti as being all auspicious for everyone. And we have the Chatur Shloka in the second canto where Krishna says that this is applicable in all places and all times for all persons. So what we would look for there is we would look for people from a variety of cultures, a variety of time and place, a variety of circumstance, who exhibit signs of spiritual enlightenment and spiritual attainment. And we would see what were they preaching. Now, of course, this gives us a problem in that we have to identify the symptoms of spiritual enlightenment. We have to get that list from somewhere. You understand? You know, if I'm going to identify acharyas or saints, I have to have some idea what is an acharya and what is a saint, and how do I get that idea. So we have a little bit of circularity because that idea tends to come from scripture. But if we have some set of criteria, what's a saint, what's an acharya, and we're looking for universal religion, we're looking for something that's true for everyone in all place, in all times, in all circumstances, then we would look throughout history, and we would look throughout nationality, throughout cultures, throughout external religions, and we would find that there is a commonality. And of course, Srila Prabhupada emphasizes this frequently, that it doesn't matter what the religion, what the culture, all the acharyas are teaching the same thing. Now, are all the acharyas, are all the prophets and the teachers of religion, of all religions, teaching the same thing in details? Not at all. So when we're saying they're teaching the same thing, what same thing are they teaching?
The essence.
Which is what? What could we bring that down to that everyone who we could identify as a saintly, enlightened person, what is the commonality of what they are teaching?
Love of God.
Love of God. Well, then there is a God, that there's some supernatural being or force or something. There's something supernatural, some supernatural consciousness, intelligence, being who is created and maintained, and we talked about destruction. And our relationship with that supreme should be one of love. And service and surrender. What other commonalities do we find?
The world is not a place to find happiness, but it's an eternal world in which you find happiness.
That happiness is not to be found in worldly things. That there's some sort of transcendent type of happiness.
Yeah.
whether it's another world, whether it's another state of consciousness, there's something beyond material experience that we should access. Any other commonalities?
They teach many of the virtues like non-violence.
Yes. Yes, there's going to be some sort of moral or ethical code. Now, the details of that moral ethical code may be quite different. But there's some sort of moral ethical code. And usually that moral ethical code has something to do with not harming others. There's something in there about not harming and not cheating and not envying and lying. Those sorts of things are considered immoral. Again, there may be differences in some of the details as to exactly what is permitted and what is not permitted. Certain kinds of foods may be permitted by one religion and not permitted by another religion. But there's some sort of moral code. So this is something that we see is universally existent. The idea that there's some transcendent supernatural intelligence, consciousness, awareness, being that is the source and creation and maintain and maintenance and destruction of the world, and that we have access to some state of consciousness in this life and or after this life beyond the ordinary, and that we should follow certain moral codes. Anything else that we could say is the same?
A practical process.
There's some sort of practical process given. And do we find similarities among those practical processes from different religions?
Yes. Glorification of the Lord's name.
There's some sort of glorification. It may not be the name, but there's some sort of prayer or glorification of this supernatural, transcendent, right? There's some sort of scripture. There's some sort of holy teachings. There may not be worship as such in every, but usually there's some kind of worship.
And representatives.
There's representatives, yes. There's some sort of human beings who teach and represent the tradition and exemplify the tradition. There's some sort of rules, often rules of cleanliness, rules of procedure, and things of that nature. Yeah. So we find that is a common thread. Again, the details may be extremely different, but we will find those threads. So what we're looking for here, this is a hard thing to say, but Srila Prabhupada himself says it, and it's throughout the Bhagavatam, but I think it's a hard thing to say, in that the way that we are practicing Bhagavad Dharma right now is not necessarily exactly the way that devotees of Krishna practice Bhagavad Dharma in other ages and at other times. And Srila Prabhupada makes this point quite clearly, very frequently, that the Dharma of the Yuga changes, the mantras change. Like the mantra that Chitraketu is chanting, we don't chant these mantras. I mean, we're chanting them in our Bhagavatam class, but we're not sitting and chanting these mantras. Or Dhruva was chanting Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. We certainly chant that mantra, but we do not sit down in meditation to chant that mantra. That is not our main mantra. The mantra that Bharat Maharaj used to worship the sun is different from the Brahma Gayatri mantra that we chant. It's a different mantra. So even those things change in time. And we engage in various forms of meditation, but it's not quite the same as the meditation that was engaged in by other persons, even in our own Bhagavatam. Is this clear to everybody? So even, and I think one of the things I really like about our Vedic tradition is that we are saying that the way to approach God and the way to achieve transcendence does change in details. You know, our arguing in ISKCON over details makes really no sense to me at all. I don't understand it. When our own tradition is a tradition where the details change. If you want to say we're following the tradition, well, you know what? We have a tradition where we are attached to principles. where we recognize that details will change over time. Just like you're going to read in Bhaktivedanta in the seventh canto that the brahmachari should wear dreadlocks and deerskin. So what's wrong with you guys? You know, you're not following the Bhagavatam. I'm supposed to have dreadlocks and old torn clothing. Should I tear holes in my clothes and go to the... Of course, nowadays, if I wanted dreadlocks, I would go to the salon and pay, you know, like a couple hundred euros and have my hair made into dreadlocks. That used to be the way that you get your hair into dreadlocks is you just don't comb it. You know, and it takes about 5 years. Dreadlocks was a sign that you had not combed your hair for 5 years. Now it's a sign that you got a few hundred euros and you went to the salon. But we're not following those details, even though it's in our own Bhagavatam. Yeah? Does that everybody follow? So what is this universal religion that we are preaching? And that's what's being discussed today. So I hope I didn't shake any of you up too much here. Is this okay?
Yeah.
All right. I think it's good to be shaken up. I want us to, we're looking today at what is Bhagavad Dharma. What is Dharma? Then how does Prabhupada define Dharma in general?
That which is inherent in the...
Inherent. It cannot be changed.
The laws of God.
The laws of God. What cannot be changed? What is the essential nature of something?
When we are discussing when this is bona fide religion, we should have an experience of... we should have a practical experience.
We definitely should.
But others may also argue saying that even in our religion, we are also having some practical experience.
We have no quarrel with that. We don't, you know, Prabhupada would often say we're not trying to convert people from one religion to another. At least I'm not. So, and Prabhupada was very clear that that is not our goal. If people don't identify with any religion, we would say, why don't you take up Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's banner? Or if they're finding that within their religious system, knowing and loving God is very difficult, then we might say, maybe you should take up the process of Lord Chaitanya. If they're very immersed in their own religious tradition, then we would say, please find bhakti in your own tradition. So if Mahaprabhu's movement took over the world, would ISKCON be the only religious organization?
Unlikely.
Unlikely, and there's only one way to do that. Historically, yeah. Historically speaking, if you make one religious organization, one church required, and no one is allowed to have any other religious affiliation, the only way that has been done historically is through
war
and force and torture and persecution. They're just, we don't have any historical evidence in the last thousands of years of anybody forcing one particular religious organization on human beings without torture and persecution. And in any case, we have four sampradayas, yes. That we, and those sampradayas have different branches. We, even in our Gaudiya sampradaya, there are different branches. We have the Chaitanya tree. Prabhupada asserts that ISKCON is one branch of the Chaitanya tree. We are not the tree, we are a branch. And Prabhupada didn't even say we have to finish Christianity and Islam and even those non-Vedic religions. What is one of the beauty of the Vedic scripture is that it does allow for a variety of spiritual and religious practice. Unlike, say, Islam, which is saying you have to accept Allah and Muhammad or we're going to cut your head off. You know, and the Christians were doing that kind of thing as well. So rather than that, we can say, look for bhakti in your own tradition. And if you can't find bhakti in your own tradition, we offer you Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's movement. I mean, the other thing is objectively, from an objective point of view, we are offering a view of God that is certainly more detailed than is offered in most religious traditions. Is this an objective fact?
More what?
More detailed.
Yes.
That if you, as I was saying, that according to just Urmila Devi Dasi, a religion should answer the question, who is God? Who am I? What is the purpose of creation? What happens at death? Why is there suffering? That's just my opinion. Does that sound reasonable? But a lot of what claims to be religion in the world today does not answer those questions very well. It really doesn't. My sister became an ultra-Orthodox Jew, and I asked her, so who is God? She said, well, I've only been practicing strictly for 10 years. I don't know yet. And I said, you know, 1 week in the Hare Krishna movement, somebody could answer that question. So from the Vedas in general, but I'd say from Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in particular, with no offense intended to other sampradayas, I'd say from Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in particular, and especially his instructions to Rupa and Sanatana Goswamis, we have a richness of understanding of the nature of God and the nature of the self and the nature of reality. Or if you look at the Bhagavatam description of the universe, if you look at Kapila Dev's description of the modes of material nature and the elements of the universe, Krishna's description of the Bhagavad Gita, this sort of description does not exist, as far as I know, in any other religious tradition. To some extent in Buddhism. But it certainly doesn't exist in Judaism, Christianity, and Islam.
Mostly concentrated on moral instructions.
Hmm?
More concentrated on moral instructions.
Who is?
Other
religions. I'd say that in general, religions tend to become materialistic over time, which means a focus on moral instructions, which means a worship of the Lord for material purpose and a focus on the moral instructions. And Krishna says this, that dharma tends to become adhan. I really don't like to say this, but I think it needs to be said. This is already happening in Islam. It is definitely happening in Islam. We have some leading preachers in Islam that are shifting toward the moral, social realm and away from the transcendent. It's already happening. You know, that's a lot easier thing to talk about. It's a lot easier thing to talk about, you know, are you moral about money? Are you moral about sex? Are you moral about your business dealings? Then are you achieving love of God? It's a lot simpler. But of course, without love of God, being moral is a little difficult. Being absolutely moral is a little, it doesn't really work that way. But anyway, it's happening with us also. It's the tendency of a religion to very quickly, it's like your room. Your room gets dirty fairly quickly, at least in India. You clean it in the morning and it's dusty in the afternoon. So it's like this with religions that, you know, as some acharya, Prabhupada talks about this in the fourth canto. As soon as the acharya leaves, things become disordered. So when there's an acharya there, it's on a very pure level, very, very quickly, people start going to the materialist. Oh, it's too high, nobody can attain Krishna consciousness anyway, it's too difficult, we'll never get it anyway, just try to, you know, make Krishna consciousness your ordinary faith and just be a good person. And it's a strong tendency. And the Prabhupada says that the followers of the Acharya have to keep reasserting the real religion. It's something that has to keep happening. And it's so difficult to do that some sort of empowered person or the Lord himself has to come periodically and do it. It just, that's what Krishna says. They have to, every once in a while, there has to be. I mean, Bhaktivinoda had to do it, and how much time after that could Srila Prabhupada come? It wasn't a very long time afterwards. So this is, it's quite common that there has to keep coming empowered persons. All right. So I'd like to look at Bhagavad Dharma, which is the eternal universal religion, as being explained here in this section of the Bhagavatam. And what we're going to work at today is we're going to be defining what is Bhagavad Dharma. We're going to talk about it in terms of that it's the Bhagavad Dharma is the Lord's victory, which is of course interesting in terms of yesterday, again military or competition terminology, with the Lord being conquered. We're going to look at this idea of sectarian and non-sectarian, which I've spent quite a bit of time talking about, that it doesn't involve envy or harm. We talked about that already, didn't we? That every religion has some moral principles, and although they differ in details, the essence of them tends to be some sort of kindness and honesty and reliability. And we're going to look at that in terms of the word dharma. So we're going to take the word Bhagavad Dharma, and we're going to divide it up. First, we're going to look at the word dharma, and we're going to look at that in terms of the definition, victory, sectarian and non-sectarian, envy or harm. We're going to touch on Prabhupada's talking about the Aryan civilization. Then we're going to talk about the Bhagavad part of Bhagavad Dharma, which involves purification, knowledge, power, and prayers. Everybody ready for our journey? Okay. So we're going to start out with dharma. And let's turn to verse 40. So here, Srila Prabhupada is giving a definition of the highest dharma. And maybe we could say the first verse altogether. Anya bilasita sunyam jnana karma anavritam anukulena krishnam shilanam bhaktirutamam. And then he gives, of course, Rupa Goswami's next verse to describe the highest dharma. We can say that together. Sarvapati vinirmuktam tatpartena nirmala rishikesha rishikena sevanam bhaktirutate. And then we knew what the next verse was going to be from Bhagavatam 1:26. Savai pun samaro dharmo yato bhaktir lokasaje ahoitu ki apatita yadya visupasidati. Okay, so I'd like you to take these three verses and work with, you can work with groups of two or three, and I'd like you to just very quickly, not more than 5 minutes, just do a little comparison of these. All right. So we have Rupa's verse, Narada's, Bhagavatam. Okay? And maybe you can find some categories and compare which of the verses talks about what. There are some things covered in all three, some things only covered in two, some things only covered in one. But please work with somebody else, at least one other person. And if you can work with two other people, that's fine.
Categories.
Yeah, figure out your own categories. And what's alike, what's different, I don't care how you do it. You can do it as a table, you can do it as a three-part Venn diagram. You can just make lists, I don't really care how you do it. Whatever you like. But I'd like you to work with somebody else. To basically compare and contrast all three verses. So you might find two verses have something in common that the other one doesn't, and the other two verses might have something in common that the third one does it, and there's something that all three of them have in common. I'd really like you to work with somebody else because I see that almost all of you are working individually. You're going to have something individually to do, don't worry, but right now please work with somebody else. As soon as you finish this, you will have something individual to do, all you people who love to work individually. Okay, now I do want you to work on your own and write, what is your definition of Bhagavad Dharma? Not more than four sentences. Write your own definition of Bhagavad Dharma based on your analysis of those three verses. Please have it not more than four sentences. So this, please do it on your own. And you have 3 minutes. That's it. At 3 minutes, we're done. If you're not done, you're done. I hope you found that enriching. Oh, thank you. I hope you found that your own understanding was deepened and enriched. Okay, I'd like us just to look at the purport to text 40. Can anybody tell me from the purport, looking at the purport, why is Bhagavad Dharma victory for the Lord? So what in the purport tells us that it's victory? If anybody could identify this, please.
The
program
you're saying.
One, two, three.
You're saying that reclaiming the fallen souls back is a victory for him. So he is getting his part of us as well.
Okay, so what is the relationship between that and Bhagavad Dharma? Can you explain that?
Because Bhagavad Dharma is all about establishing loving devotional service with the Lord. So when one follows that, it is victory because they're coming back to Krishna.
Why does Krishna think it's a victory to bring them back?
Because they're suffering in the material world and with a wrong identification.
They were lost.
He wants them back, okay.
Yeah.
Does anyone have an experience in their own life, either in their own Krishna consciousness or in helping others that they think of as a victory that they'd like to share? Take like maybe two experiences. Yes.
Yes, at one time I met a lady who is a bishop from the United States of America.
Okay.
Yeah, so she was, they stole her passport.
Oh.
And she was stranded. So I brought her to temple. I started cultivating her. Now she's initiated and now she's a devotee.
Uh-huh, and you felt that was a victory?
Yeah.
Yes, very nice. And we can take one more. Yes.
I was talking with a friend, she's a Christian. And she is close into that God cannot be worshipped, we cannot give a form to God because then we are living in God. And she was very stressing that point. And told her, yes, I agree with you, God is energy, but if you negate that he has a form, this is also limiting. And she said, oh, I never thought it that way. So that was a small victory.
It was a small victory that she changed her mentality. Okay. We're going to go on to the next aspect of Bhagavad Dharma, the fact that it is non-sectarian. And I'd like us to look in text 41. So looking at text 41, the verse and the purport. And this is going to be a little bit of a challenge for me logistically. Okay, I'd like you to just suggest from the verse of the purport, how is Bhagavad Dharma not sectarian?
Because it doesn't make distinctions, it's for everyone. There is no envy.
Well, those are two different things. Okay, so no envy,
yeah.
Which we'll have to talk about separately, and no distinctions.
Yeah. Open for everyone.
For everyone. Okay, somebody else? How is Bhagavad Dharma non-sectarian from this verse in purport 41?
It is only surrender to God.
What?
It is only surrender to God.
Surrender to God.
When someone becomes Krishna conscious, they think that this person is for Krishna and Krishna belongs to them. So Krishna is centered.
I'm Krishna's, and Krishna mine. So it's Krishna-centered. Some more, somebody else. Yes.
Following these systems, anybody who is following this system just cannot have any enemy.
No enemies.
No.
So no envy or enemies.
We are all eternal, fragmental part of the world.
To carry the order of the Lord.
Yeah, I'd really like to hear from people who haven't said anything yet. So, someone who hasn't said anything yet, what do you find in text 41 that shows that Bhagavad Dharma is not sectarian? If you haven't yet said anything, please.
There is no concoctions in the Bhagavad Dharma.
You already said something.
There are friendship with all living entities.
You said something.
No.
You didn't have. Did you already say something or no? He did, but you didn't. Okay.
It is God's word directly, and God is one. Dharmam Sakshat, that was the reason.
Someone else who hasn't said anything. Yes?
It's beneficial for everyone.
I think you said something. I want to ask people who haven't said it. Yes.
That is the order of the world.
God's word and grand order. Someone else who hasn't yet said it.
Everything is factual.
Okay, let's look at the list that I came up with before the class, and let's see if I came up with anything that no one else got. I got seen equally, got the I in mind, I got that the contradictions are absent, freedom from enemies, I got God is present in everything. I don't think we have that here. God is present in everything. The other things I got, everybody. So a sectarian religion is like, it's for me, but it's not for you, right? And we have our group, and we have another group. We have different competing groups. It's something that's concocted. It's something that's temporary. I'm sure we could find a lot more ways, but I wanted to look particularly at this verse in purport to see the ways in which it's not sectarian. And I'd like each of you to take one of these right now, just individually, take one of these and write one or two sentences about it, anyone you want. Take any of these and just write one or two sentences about it. In relationship to Bhagavad Dharma being not sectarian. For example, you'd write, the fact that Bhagavad Dharma benefits everyone means it's not sectarian because. How does benefiting everyone mean that it's not sectarian? I want to look specifically at the lack of envy, because this is mentioned in text 42. And How can a religious system that produces envy of oneself and of others be beneficial for oneself and for them? What is auspicious about following such a system?
I had a hard time to understand one thing here, what it means to be envious of oneself.
Excellent question. Prabhupada starts out here in the purport, any religious system but the process of Bhagavad Dharma service as an eternal servant of the Supreme Personality of Godhead is a system of envy of one's own self and others. So who is our self?
Souls.
Oh, let's go a step further. Mahaprabhu says, Swarupaya Shara Nitya Das, that we are eternally a
servant.
Generally speaking, we hate the idea of being a servant. I say this all over the world, and no one's ever argued with me about this. I don't know of any family that tells their children, I want you to grow up and become a servant. It's just, you know, even if your parents are servants, they say, I want you to be a doctor or a lawyer or an IT specialist, or if you're Indian, and if you're in the other parts of the world, though, maybe okay if you're a musician or a teacher. But who tells their kids, grow up and be a servant? So what are your, so, oh, nice to see you. What are your kids doing? Well, my daughter cleans a hotel, and my son's a waiter. I mean, who wants to say that? They'd rather say that than, you know, my kids are dealing drugs at the corner store. But it's not, that's not what you want to say about your children. You want to say, you know, my son's a banker, right? That's what you want to say. We don't like the idea of being a servant. Why is it that we've replaced most servants with machines? Because people don't want to do service. I can't remember if I was talking to Radhika Raman or his wife, but Radhika Raman is Indian, but he grew up in America. He married an Indian woman who grew up in India. And when they got married in India, she said, I think I'd like 15 children. And when they moved to America, she said, I think I don't want more than 2 or 3. And he said, why did you change your mind? She said, well, in India, the servant comes and takes the laundry and washes it and dries it and irons it and folds it up and puts it away. And in America, I have to take the laundry, I have to sort it out, I have to put it in the machine, I have to set up the machine, I have to take it out of the machine, I have to put it in the dryer, I have to take it out of the dryer, I have to iron it, I have to fold it, and I have to put it away. You know, we think of India as a poor country, but in India, anybody can get a personal tailor. In America, for a personal tailor, I mean, that's a rich person. You know, you're a rich person, you go to a fancy, fancy store like Saks Fifth Avenue, you will get what's called a personal shopper. You will get someone who will go around the store with you and help you pick out clothes, and then you'll get a tailor to go into the dressing room and try them on, and they pin the clothes for you, and they tailor it for you when you pick them up. This is, rich people do this. Ordinary people don't do this in the United States or Europe. And in this country, you go to any of these shops, you get a personal shopper. Right? And they fit it on you, and they pin it, and you get a tailor, and it's custom made for you. But in the wealthy countries of the world, we've eliminated most servants. We've replaced servants with machines and factories. People don't want to be servants. We hate the fact that we're a servant. It really bothers us. And what is envy? Envy means that you don't like something that someone has. You want them not to have it. You'd like to have it, but if you can't have it, at least you want them not to have it. That is envy. Yeah? If you have something I don't have, or you have more of something, I would like to take it from you, and if I can't do that, at least I don't want you to have it. That is what envy is. So I'm trying to take from myself the fact that I'm a servant. I hate that I'm a servant, and I want to take that away from myself. I don't want to serve anybody, ever, about anything. I want to be the master. I want everyone to serve me. I mean, I'm willing to do some service for somebody as a way of getting them to do some service for me. So, you know, I've learned from my parents and my society that if I never do anything for anybody else, I'll never get anybody to do anything for me. But that's, I'm not doing something for somebody because I want to serve them. I'm doing something for somebody as a way to be the master. Yes? So this is envy of one's own self. It's a hatred of one's own self.
Hating that I am a servant.
I'm hating my very nature of being a servant. And it's quite a deep thing. It's really quite a deep thing. I remember many years ago I was talking with a devotee who was quoting what Bhaktisiddhanta wrote, that Prabhupada reads that Krishna is a transcendental autocrat. And as soon as I heard the word autocrat, I felt a rebellion well up in my heart.
What is an autocrat?
What is an autocrat?
One who stands by himself?
More than that.
Dictates?
Yes, a dictator. An autocrat is a dictator. And autocrat is a very bad word in 2019. We think of an autocrat, we think of like a Stalin or somebody like that. That's kind of the, yes? That's kind of the association. So this devotee was saying, you know, I heard it dozens of times, but somehow Krishna is the transcendental autocrat. And I could feel something in my heart going, no! So this is an envy of ourself. That I hate the fact that Krishna is the autocrat. I don't care if he's a transcendental autocrat. I don't want any autocrats. I don't want to be a servant of some autocrat. Forget that. So I may go around politely in ISKCON, oh, I'm your servant, Prabhu. I'm your servant, Prabhu. I'm your servant, Prabhu. How may I serve you, Prabhu? But in my heart, I'm going, no! I am not serving an autocrat! No! So this is envy of ourself. It's a hatred of who I am. I mean, I think that many of us experience a hatred of who we are on a mundane, temporary level. We all have a particular nature and personality in this lifetime, and there are parts of our nature and personality in this lifetime that we do not like. Is there anyone here who likes every single thing about their nature in this lifetime? So there are parts about the way that we think and the way that we act that we really just don't like, and we wish we could get rid of. Am I the only one with this problem, or does anybody have this problem? And we may have tried to change these things and it just doesn't work. We're kind of stuck with who we are, but we just don't like it very much. So that's on a mundane level, that there are aspects of our body or aspects of our personality or certain ways we have of acting or being that annoy ourselves. They don't just annoy other people. Does everybody have this? You know. So that's okay if we're thinking about our mundane body and mind, which is certainly full of faults. But it's the same kind of thing. That we're annoyed or irritated with the fact that we're essentially a servant. We want to be the master. We want to be the top. We want to be the supreme. Whenever we feel irritation at someone else's glorification, when we are not glorified, whenever we feel irritation at someone's neglect of us, whenever we feel irritation, you know, at somebody who's anything that they have that's as good or better than us, this is an indication of an envy of ourselves, of a hatred of ourselves. It's not just an envy of others. It's a hatred of our own position as being very insignificant. You know, when I want people to notice me and they don't notice me, you know, when Maharaj this morning said that Mataji instead of calling me by name, although he knows me very well, I was like, You're not going to say Urmila, you're going to say that Mataji. You know, that thought came immediately. So this tendency of wanting to be honored, wanting to be master, wanting to have some position, wanting to have some power, some control, it's all an envy of ourselves, is what it is. At least we're in a system of dharma where we know that that's not good and we're dealing with it. Whereas in many systems of religion, that way of thinking is encouraged. It's actually encouraged. You know, we're the best religion, we have all the right answers, we're the best people, we're going to show everybody else what to do. And, you know, they talk about being the agents of God, but they don't talk about real deep humility and real deep service. And then your envy of others. So, of course, the primary way of this is in meat eating, where we so much wish harm to others that we're eating them. So what are we going to do about this? Just have like half a minute here. Any idea about what we're going to do about this envy of ourselves and envy of others?
What can we do with it?
What are we going to do about it? Give it up.
We can try to understand the glory of being a servant.
To understand the glory of being a servant. What I found also for myself is a real focus on Krishna as benevolent. The Suridam Sarvanitanam, where Krishna gives this peace formula, Bhaktiram Yagatapasam Sarvalok Maheshram.
He's a benevolent
autocrat. And in one sense, we're all longing to be under the protection of a benevolent autocrat. You know, for all of the push for democracy in the world, people still want a strong leader who's benevolent. I mean, all the interest in the Queen of England, who's basically a figurehead. We long for this. And if we don't find it in someone in government, we look for it in an actor, a movie actor, right? Or a sports figure, or a scientist. You know, we keep looking for that person to whom we can surrender and to whom we can serve. So I found ways of dealing with this is really the Suridam Sarvanitana. That Krishna is the friend of all living. He's my friend. He's not going to hurt me as the autocrat. And then I find, when I meditate on that, I find that there's a lot of joy in service, and I really relish the idea of being a servant, and I really relish even the idea of being a very insignificant servant. And a servant that's not noticed by anybody but Krishna. It becomes a very sweet thing. That's for me, but I think for each of us, it's something that we would do well to meditate on. What is it I can do? Because I've said this now 5 times today, and I really wish I didn't have to say things like this. But it is possible to go on superficially as a devotee of Krishna and not hit this thing for many, 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 many verses. It's entirely possible to, you know, follow a bunch of rules and follow moral codes and learn the right prayers and learn the right way of acting, and not touch this thing. Kind of dance around it, that Krishna's the master and I'm the servant. And to love that, not to accept it as alright, Krishna's the master and I'm the servant. Mm-hmm. Or fearful, he's the master and I'm the servant. Oh my God. But to really, like, I'm a servant. It's just so nice. I'm a servant. Krishna's the autocrat. Whoa! Sorry, baby. What do we need? This is something, this is, you said you do all your homework in class, but this is a homework for outside of class. To really meditate and pray on today after class sometime. What is it? Maybe ask Krishna, what is it I can do so I really notice this? So I really give up this envy of myself. And I, as Krishna says, relish and rejoice in self. But I take great pleasure in being an insignificant servant of an autocratic master. And we talked yesterday about how Krishna is conquered by the devotees. Yeah, that may help. How even though Krishna is an autocrat, that he is. His victory is bringing us to love, where he becomes conquered by us. We don't really have time to talk about how we can avoid harming others as a separate topic, but I would just like to say that when we relish being a servant of Krishna, we automatically stop harming others. Because all of our harming of others is in our attempts to be something other than a servant. That's a very deep statement, which could take a tremendous amount of unpacking. We could be unpacking that statement for a week or two, but I simply will have to give it to all of you to unpack that within the confines of your own heart. That all of our harm to others, all the time, comes from this not rejoicing, relishing, celebrating being a servant of the transcendental life. That any, even the slightest minuscule envy that we have of that, the slightest resistance we have to this concept that I'm a servant of an autocrat, puts us in a position where we try to make others our servant, and therefore we hurt them, because we are not a fully beneficial transcendental autocrat. When we stop relishing being a servant, we become the type of autocrat that we are afraid of. We're afraid. I don't want to surrender to Krishna as the autocrat. He's going to hurt me. Therefore, we become an autocrat, but we become a dictator type of autocrat. We become a harmful type of autocrat, and therefore we envy others. But again, I don't have time to unpack that now. I'm just going to leave you with that. Very full sutras. So we're going to go on to text 43, where Chitraketu is using the word Arya, Aryaha, those who are advanced in civilization. So we have a problem with this word because of our Hitler, that he used this word to justify genocide and cruelty, which is another very poignant example of how religion can be perverted. He took the swastika, he took the word Arya, and he turned it into something ugly and nasty and vicious and cruel. So when Srila Prabhupada says in this purport that that we should all become Aryans, so people may not be very enthusiastic about this. it's here in Prabhupada's books, but honestly, this is not a term that we use with the public. And I don't suggest you do use it with the public. I think it's a term that Prabhupada uses it, it's used by Chitraketu, it's in the Shastra, but it's probably we should use a different term with the public.
Or we can translate it.
Yeah, find another word. Find another synonym. Civilized people, high class people, living according to gods, yeah. I mean, maybe in 200 years it can be used again, but right now it still has that connection. Okay, so what constitutes an Aryan? Because Srila Prabhupada's making this statement here, in this, right? He's saying everyone should become a member of the Aryan civilization.
One who lives according to the laws.
Well, look in the purport. Like, look in the purport, and what do you find from the purport?
Aryans who strictly follow the instructions of the Lord and never deviate from those instructions.
Okay, so Aryans are people who follow Krishna without deviation. Another, yes?
They see everybody as equal.
See everyone equally. See everyone equally. Does this mean that you think that two-year-olds can drive cars? No. So what is, what are you seeing? What's equal? Everyone is of equal what?
Sure.
Lord says, Mame Vansha Ji, Loki Ji, Purpusnata, we are all the Ansho.
But what is it when I'm seeing you equally? What is it, what am I seeing equally? I mean, like, you're older than she is, okay? You're probably stronger than he is. So what does it mean I'm seeing you all equally?
According to one's capacity.
But that, okay, but that's... It means I'm seeing the soul, not the body. And in what sense is the soul, are all the souls equal? Well, practically. Yeah?
The Shastra says to see the super soul in everybody.
Okay.
And everybody is acting, whatever acting, because of the three modes.
So that has a practical implication. If I look at everyone here and I see that Krishna's in their heart, what would you do? Look, everybody, look around the room and meditate on the fact that Krishna's with each of these people. Just look around the room for a minute. How does that change? Did that change your feeling about the people in the room? Yeah. And Bhaktisiddhanta said, then we don't become a reformer of anyone because we know that no one is without the highest guidance. It makes us stop trying to push people to be what we think that they should be. We have some trust that Krishna is in their heart and he's guiding them. And we can act as Krishna's instrument, but it's Krishna who's guiding them. Now, when you say that people are acting according to the three modes of material nature, this gives us compassion. What else equally? What would that... Everyone is of equal what?
As a servant of the Lord.
Everyone is equal as a servant of the Lord, which means everyone has equal...
right to serve the Lord.
Everyone has equal right to serve the Lord. That's very, very, very important.
So first of
all, we just talked about that, yes. But everyone has equal... value. Everyone has equal value. Nobody has more value than anybody else. Now, materially, that's just not true. That just isn't true.
But
I'm talking about practically. What does that mean? I don't invite elephants into my house for prasadam, okay? I can see Hastini, I see the elephant equal to the brahmana, but I'm not going to ask an elephant to come into my house and sit down and have some halwa. So what does it mean that I see the elephant and the brahmana equal? They're of equal value. The Lord is with each of them. The Lord loves each of them equally. The Lord does not love the soul in the brahmana's heart more than the soul in the elephant's heart, and they have equal value. Again, practically, we don't have funerals for dead ants. Okay? But a human being dies, doesn't matter who it is. It could be a criminal. It could be a serial killer. But that human body is generally, except sometimes in war or epidemics, that human body is given a burial. When the government executes a criminal, could be, you know, somebody who killed 500 people, but they're going to give that human body a burial. Correct? Nobody gives a burial to a dead ant that I know of. I'll be happy to be proven wrong, but I've never seen anybody take a little dead ant and they just sweep it out the door. So we do show differentiation, but every soul has equal value. Every soul has equal value. What else did the audience do?
They don't kill
They don't kill any being unnecessarily. Not killing any living being is impossible, but we don't kill any living being unnecessarily. I can't breathe or walk without killing some living entity. Another one? In this purport? reciprocal.
Eager to satisfy Krishna.
Eager to satisfy Krishna. Very nice. What else?
Irrespective of their guna and karma.
Excellent. They act according to their qualities and work. People are, and this is, again, we don't have time, but this is something we could talk about for weeks. How important it is to act according to our nature. What does that mean? It means that on a material level, who I am materially. Am I a quiet, introverted person? Am I a loud, outgoing, extroverted person? Am I very artistic? Am I very introspective? Am I very intuitive? Am I very analytic? Do I see the big picture? Do I see details? Do I love to work with ideas? Do I love to manage people and make sure they're taken care of? You know, do I love to produce wealth? Do I love to work with nature? Do I love to produce beauty in the world? Do I love to have the world working properly? Do I enjoy beauty? Do I enjoy power? Do I enjoy strength and health? Do I enjoy freedom? Do I enjoy knowledge? What do I enjoy? What do I like? How am I wired? What gives me happiness, and what do I do sort of automatically? To take that thing, whatever it is, and to have my source of livelihood be in accord with that nature. It's basically like saying that the cells in our body that are heart muscle should be part of the heart, and the souls of our body that are stomach cells should be in the stomach, and the cells of our body that are brain, that are neurons, should be in the brain, and my fat cells should be, you know, in my skin, and my bone cells should be in my bones. Like, well, duh. I don't want my bone cells in my, you know, hair. That would be a little inconvenient. So that whatever I do naturally, whatever is the most full, natural, and real expression of myself, materially speaking, is how I contribute to society and how I maintain myself. Just like the cell that is a heart muscle, by acting as a heart, it does its best service for the body and it gets its own nourishment. Does everybody understand that? When the neuron cell in my brain, when it acts as part of the brain, it serves the whole body in the best way, and it gets its own food. It gets its own food, it gets its own defense. So in Aryan civilization, people understand what is their role, what are they best suited for. And they contribute that to society, and that's how they get their sustenance. It's not that they have a means of work that's opposite to their nature, and then they just do their nature as a hobby. And another thing here is free from doubts. So let's say the whole world were like this, seeing everyone as equal value and worth, not killing others necessarily, acting according to their nature, following Krishna, being free from doubts. Would it be a nice world? It would be a very nice world. I have to go, I'm sorry, I'm running out of time. So this is, I'm sure it's valuable, but I'm really running out of time. Prabhu, I'm really running out of time. I'm trying to, as politely as possible, say that I'm not going to take your comment. If you want me to say it impolitely, I will. I don't have trouble going from polite to impolite very quickly. Okay, I want to go now to the Bhagavad part, particular Bhagavad part of Bhagavad Dharma, and we're going to have to go to this very quickly because we literally have just 6 minutes, so I'm going to be racing through this, and I'm not going to have time for discussion on this, for which I apologize. But the nature of the Bhagavad part of Bhagavad Dharma, the fact that it's not just Dharma, but it's Bhagavad Dharma, means that one becomes purified. Now, Prabhupada speaks in text 44 about just chanting once, one can become purified. And we think about Chitraketu's experience that we already talked about, how just 1 week he became the head of the Vidyadharas, and a few days later he saw the Lord. And Prabhupada says, by offering food to the deity and by decorating and serving the deity, one gets the same result that one derives from serving the Lord, personally in Vaikuntha. What a beautiful thing to meditate on. If we had time, I would ask for your experiences, and I'm sorry that I'm running out of time. In text 45, Prabhupada talks about Bhagavad Dharma involving the grace of the guru. And we see this very clearly in Chitraketu's experience, in getting the grace of Narada, in getting the grace of Angira. And here again, I would have liked to ask everybody for your experiences with guru and the grace of guru. So I'm just going to have to throw this at you as something that you can meditate on from this section. How have you received the grace of the deity, and how have you received the grace of guru in your own spiritual life? And then knowledge. So this is in text 46 purport. And Prabhupada makes this statement. Materialistic so-called chemists and atheistic philosophers always try to avoid even the name of God in relation to the cosmic manifestation. Oh, wow, is that true? I know that when I preach in universities, you know, when I preach to the public, it's really awkward to use the word God. And it's getting worse and worse and worse. You know, you have to say, like Bhakti Mark Swami said, I never use the word God, I just say the divine. You know, I even went through the novel here, Essence Seekers, and I thought, let me look at every time I use the word God. And is there another, could I use another word? The source. I was at a college preaching program where I talked about the source. And thank you, Krishna, one of the students said, could you talk more about the source? But, you know, our source, our foundation, the creator, the divine, people just real. It's again this envy of self, isn't it? Not wanting this, the transcendental autocrat. So we get real knowledge. And then, of course, we have the power of Bhagavan. And anybody remember what Prabhupada talked about? The universes were carried by the Lord as if the universes were?
Mustard seeds.
So this is also something you can do on your own. Get a mustard seed and put it on your head. If I had more time and facility, I would do that. I would have brought a bunch of mustard seeds and I would have passed them out and had everybody put one on their head. And then, but you can imagine. Can you imagine that right now, that you got a mustard seed on your head? Would you feel it?
No.
No, we wouldn't feel it. And imagine that's a whole universe. So for the Lord, the whole universe is just like carrying around a mustard seed on his head. And we also have in text 49, the last verse in the section that we're doing this morning, which is where we go to Sukadeva Goswami speaking, where he's saying that the Lord was very pleased with these prayers of Chitraketu. So Srila Prabhupada says, in relationship to the story of Jambavana, that the Lord has all the sentiments of an ordinary human being. Do we like it when people praise us?
Yes.
We might pretend we don't like it, but come on. We all like being praised. Now, we don't like flattery. We don't like praise when we think that someone's trying to manipulate us. That we don't like. But genuine praise, everybody likes genuine praise.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because also we think that person is satisfied.
Yes. So the Lord also likes genuine praise. So this is another thing you could meditate on is what is it about genuine praise and genuine prayers that is pleasing to the Lord? And how can I pray to the Lord in the same way that I'm pleased if people say nice things about me? I'll just tell you a very simple story in this regard, that most of the time when we praise others, we praise their results or we praise their motives. The problem with that is that, are any of us here fully in control of the results of our actions?
No.
So if I praise your results, then you're going to think, well, I don't know to what extent I can claim responsibility for that. And if I praise your motives, what happens when someone praises my motives? is my mind, at least my mind, immediately finds fault with myself. So if you say to me, oh, Ramila, you're such a sincere devotee, then I'm going to think, well, you just didn't see what I did way back in 1975 when I yelled at that person, and you wouldn't think I was a sincere devotee then. You know, I find some way of not accepting it. If someone says, well, you're very devoted, you're very sincere, whatever. You know, it's hard for me to accept that. I just think, well, I'm not really. If someone talks about what I've done, if it's very objective, then I find that I can, not only do I digest that, and not only do I appreciate it, but I find that it inspires me in my ongoing service. So, and the more specific it is, the more I find that to be the case. So if someone says, you know, I really like that particular picture you put on the PowerPoint, and it just brought out the meaning of it for me, and I remember that, or I like that particular exercise you did because it woke us up and it helped me, you know, I remember that 5 years ago that you did that. That kind of thing really helps me. So I had, recently I was at a meeting where it was a meeting of people on different sides, very strongly on different sides, of an extremely important and extremely confident, controversial question in ISKCON, having to do with the editing of Srila Prabhupada's books. So it was a meeting called by the BBT, and the people there were very strongly opinionated on different sides of this issue, and it's a very important issue. And at a certain point in the meeting, I did something that I do occasionally. And I started glorifying some of the people there. But I glorify them for what they do. And what I did was I tried to meditate on what they do that is invisible to others. You know, when you're running the BBT, you have to deal with legal cases, and this person is trying to get the copyright, and the Ritvik Temple in Long Island is trying to take all the money from the BBT, which is true, by the way. And, you know, you're trying to protect Srila Prabhupada's books, and at the same time, you're producing all these different translations, and you have to find the right translator. And I went down a list of what it is that different people in that meeting actually do on a daily basis. And one of the people, particularly right after I did that, because I did it with a number of people, said to me, how did you know that? Well, I had to think about it for a while, or I also prayed quite a bit. But I thought about what was the likely thing that the different people there did. And I found that by doing that, and I found this many, many times in many, many circumstances, that people then open up to working with each other because they genuinely feel appreciated, because they are genuinely appreciated. I've also found that that kind of praise is almost impossible to give insincerely. I suppose it's possible, but I have not found it possible. I am not able to praise people like that insincerely or in a manipulative fashion. I'll say theoretically it must be possible for somebody. And I find that people really, really, really deeply appreciate that kind of acknowledgement and that kind of praise. And so does Krishna. And you will find the prayers in the Shastra are often very specific like that. You do this. You do this. This is what you do. You think about this. You do. They're very, very specific. And Krishna's like, oh, someone's looking at me and really appreciating me for who I am and what I do. A couple of other very minor things. In 42, following a system of religion that does not awaken one's Krishna consciousness is merely a waste of time and labor. Of course, this reminds us of the verse in the first canto that says, Shama Evihi Kevalam. So if we're following a system of religion and we don't become aware of God, we don't know God and we don't love Him, we're wasting our time. It's not a system of religion. And the other thing in text 43, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu wanted everyone to become a guru and preach the instructions of Krishna everywhere. So just to recap today, and then we have a break. So what we talked about today, we started out by talking about how do we define religion? What is a religion? How can we say something's a religion? How do we say that what we have is a bona fide and universal religion? I talked about that for quite some time. Then we looked about Dharma, and we looked at the three verses that define Dharma in text 40, Anyabhirasitasunyam, Sarvapadhyam, Sarvapam Sampuro Dharmo. You did an analysis of those three verses, and each of you came up with your own definition of Bhagavad Dharma based on those three verses. And we talked about how Bhagavad Dharma is victory for the Lord because it brings us back to our original position of happiness. We talked a lot about how Bhagavad Dharma is not sectarian. Right, we went through the list from text 41, how it's not sectarian, and then each of you took one of those and expanded on how that means it's not sectarian. We talked a lot about that Bhagavad Dharma is not envious, and because it's not envious, it's not harmful. And then we talked about Aryan civilization, how an Aryan civilization, what are the qualities of an Aryan, and why we would want the world to be under Aryan civilization. And I briefly ran through the fact that Bhagavad Dharma means purification, knowledge, an appreciation of the power of God, and a reciprocation with the Lord through prayer and appreciation. So I hope you've all enjoyed this discussion on Bhagavad Dharma, and that we've gained an appreciation for how what Srila Prabhupada and Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu have given us is this universal position of Bhagavad Dharma, and that we could answer ourselves and others with the questions we brought up at the beginning of the class: what is religion, and why would we say that we have the actual universal religion? So we will see you at 2:30, Krishna Hare Krishna, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.